The captain lifted the dish with both hands to his own lips and took a mouthful. Then he rinsed his mouth and gargled with it noisily. He spat the mouthful and grinned at Tungata, then held the dish up before his face. Slowly and deliberately he tipped the dish, and the water spilled into the dust at Tungata's feet. It splashed his legs to the knees. Each drop felt cold as ice chips, and every cell of Tungata's body craved for it, with a strength that was almost madness. The captain inverted the dish and let the last drops fall. "Heavy man," he repeated mindlessly, and turned to shout an order at his men. They doubled away across the parade ground, leaving Tungata alone with the dead and the flies. They came for him at sunset. When they cut his wrist bonds, he groaned involuntarily at the agonizing rush of fresh blood into his swollen hands and fell to his knees. His legs could not support him. They had to half-carry him to his hut. The room was bare, except for an uncovered toilet bucket in the corner and two bowls in the centre of the baked mud floor. One dish contained a pint of water, the other a handful of stiff white maize cake. The cake was heavily oversalted. On the morrow he would pay for eating it in heavy coin of thirst, but he had to have strength. He drank half the water and set the rest aside for the morning, and then he stretched out on the bare floor. Residual heat beat down on him from the corrugated iron roof, but by morning he knew he would be shivering with cold. He ached in every joint of his body, and his head pounded with the effects of the sun and the glare, until he thought his skull would pop like a ripe cream of tartar pod on a baobab tree. Outside, in the darkness beyond the wire, the hyena packs disputed the feast that had been laid for them. Their cries and howls were a lunatic bedlam of greed, punctuated by the crunch of bone in great jaws. Despite it all, Tungata slept and woke to the tramp of feet and shouted orders in the dawn. Swiftly, he gulped down the remains of the water to fortify himself and then squatted over the bucket. His body had so nearly played him false the day before. He would not let it happen today. The door was flung open. "Out, you Matabele dog! Out of your stinking kennel!" They marched him back to the wall. There were three other naked Matabele facing it already. Irrelevantly, he noticed that they had lime-washed the wall. They were very conscientious about that. He stood with his face 2 feet from the pristine white surface and steeled himself for the day ahead. They shot the three other prisoners at noon. This time Tungata could not lead them in the singing. He tried, but his throat closed up on him. By the middle of the afternoon, his vision was breaking up into patches of darkness and stabbing white light. However, every time his legs collapsed and he fell forward against his bound wrists, the pain in his shoulder sockets, as his arms twisted upwards, revived him. The thirst was unspeakable. The patches of darkness in his head became deeper and lasted longer. The pain could no longer revive him completely. Out of one of the dark areas a voice spoke. "My dear fellow," said the voice, "this is all terribly distasteful to me." The voice of Peter Fungabera drove away the darkness and gave Tungata new strength. He struggled upright, lifted his head, and forced his vision to clear. He looked at Peter Fungabera's face, and his hatred came to arm him. He cherished his hatred as a life-giving force. Peter Fungabera was in fatigues and beret. He carried his swagger stick in his right hand. At his side was a white man whom Tungata had never seen before. He was tall and slim and old. His head was freshly shaven, his skin ruined with cicatrices, and his eyes were a strange pale shade of blue that Tungata found as repulsive and chilling as the stare of a cobra. He was watching Tungata with clinical interest, devoid of pity or other human sentiment. "I regret that you are not seeing Comrade Minister Zibiwe at his best," Peter told the white man. "He has lost a great deal of weight, but not here." With the tip of the swagger stick, Peter Fungabera lifted the heavy black bunch of Tungata's naked genitalia. "Have you ever seen anything like that?" he asked, using the swagger stick with the same dexterity as a chopstick. Bound to the stake, Tungata could not pull away. It was the ultimate degradation, this arrogant mauling and examination of his private parts. "Enough for 3 ordinary men," Peter estimated with mock admiration, and Tungata glared at him wordlessly. The Russian made an impatient gesture, and Peter nodded. You are right. We are wasting time. He glanced at his wristwatch, and then turned to the captain who was close by, waiting for his squad. Bring the prisoner up to the fort. They had to carry Tungata. Peter Fungabera's quarters in the blockhouse on the central rock koppie were spartanly furnished, but the dirt floor had been freshly swept and sprinkled with water. He and the Russian sat on one side of the trestle table that served as a desk. There was a wooden bench on the opposite side facing them. The guards helped Tungata to the bench. He pushed their hands away and sat upright, glaring silently at the two men opposite him. Peter said something to the captain in Shona, and they brought a cheap grey blanket and draped it over Tungata's shoulders. Another order, and the captain carried in a tray on which stood a bottle of vodka and another of whisky, two glasses, an ice bucket, and a pitcher of water. Tungata did not look at the water. It took all his self-control, but he kept his eyes on Peter Fungabera's face. Now, this is much more civilized, Peter said. The comrade minister Zebiwe speaks no Shona, only the primitive Sindabeli dialect, so we will use the language common to all of us, English. He poured vodka and whiskey, and as the ice clinked into the glasses, Tungata winced, but kept his gaze fixed on Peter Fungabera. This is a briefing, Peter explained. Our guest, he indicated the old white man, is a student of African history. He has read and remembered everything ever written about this country, while you, my dear Tungata, are a sprig of the House of Kumalo, the old robber chiefs of the Matabele, who for 100 years raided and terrorized the legitimate owners of this land, the Mashona people. Therefore, both of you might already know something of what I am about to relate. If that is so, I beg your indulgence. He sipped his whiskey, and neither of the other two moved or spoke. We must go back 150 years, said Peter, to when a young field commander of the Zulu King Shaka, a man who was the king's favourite, failed to render up to Shaka the spoils of war. This man's name was Mzilikazi, son of Mashobani of the Kumalo sub-tribe of Zulu, and he was to become the first Matabele. In passing, it is interesting to note that he set a precedent for the tribe, which he was to found. Firstly, he was a master of rapine and plunder, a famous killer. Then, he was a thief. He stole from his own sovereign. He failed to render to Chaka the king's share of the spoils. Then Mzilikazi was a coward, for when Shaka sent for him to face retribution, he fled. Peter smiled at Tungata. Killer, thief, and coward. That was Mzilikazi, father of the Matabele. And that description fits every member of the tribe from then until the present day. Killer, thief, coward. He repeated the insults with relish, and Tungata watched his face with eyes that glowed. So this paragon of manly virtues, taking with him his regiment of renegade Zulu warriors, fled northwards. He fell upon the weaker tribes in his path and took their herds and their young women. This was the so-called Amfekani, the Great Killing. It is said that 1 million defenseless souls perished under the Matabele assegais. Certainly Mzilikazi left behind him an empty land, a land of bleached skulls and burned-out villages. He blazed this path of destruction across the continent until he met, coming from the southwest, a foe more bloodthirsty, more avaricious even than he, the white men. The Boers. They shot down Mzilikazi's vaunted killers like rabid dogs. So Mzilikazi, the coward, ran again. Northwards, again. Peter gently agitated the ice cubes in his glass, a soft tinkling that made Tungata blink, but he did not look down at the glass. Bold Mzilikazi crossed the Limpopo River and found a pleasant land of sweet grass and clear waters. It was inhabited by a gentle, pastoral people, descendants of a race who had built great cities of stone, a comely people whom Mzilikazi contemptuously named the Eaters of Dirt, and referred to as his cattle. He treated them like cattle, killing them for sport, or husbanding them to provide his indolent warriors with slaves. The young woman of Mashona, if they were nubile, were mounted for pleasure and used as breeding stock to provide more warriors for his murderous impis. But then, you know all this.
The broad facts, yes, the old white man nodded, but not your interpretation of them, which proves that history is merely propaganda written by the victors.
Peter laughed. I hadn't heard it put that way before. However, it is true.
Now, we, the Shona, are the ultimate victors, so it is our right to redraft history. Go on, the white man invited. I find this instructive.
Very well. In the year 1868, as white men measure time, Mzilikazi, this great fat debauched and diseased killer, died. It is amusing to recall that his followers kept his corpse 56 days in the heat of Matabeleland before committing it to burial, so he stank in death as powerfully as he did in life. Another endearing Matabele trait. He waited for Tungata to protest, and when he did not, went on. One of his sons succeeded him. Lobengula, the one who drives like the wind, as fat and devious and bloodthirsty as his illustrious father. However, at almost the same time as he took the chieftainship of the Matabele, two seeds were sown that would soon grow into great creeping vines that would choke and finally bring the fat bull of Kumalo crashing to earth. He paused for effect, like a practiced storyteller, and then held up one finger. Firstly, far to the south of his plundered domains, the white men had found on a desolate koppie in the veldt a little shiny pebble. And secondly, from a dismal island far to the north, a sickly young white man embarked on a ship, seeking clean, dry air for his weak lungs.
The koppie was soon dug away by the white ants and became a hole a mile across and 400 feet deep. The white men called it Kimberley, after the foreign secretary in England who condoned its theft from the local tribes. The sickly white man was named Cecil John Rhodes, and he proved to be even more devious and cunning and unprincipled than any Matabele king. He simply ate up the other white men who had discovered the copy of shiny stones. He bullied and bribed and cheated and wheedled until he owned it all. He became the richest man in the world. However, the winning of these shiny pebbles called for enormous amounts of physical labour by tens of thousands of men. Whenever there is hard work to be done, where does the white man in Africa look? Peter chuckled and left his rhetorical question unanswered. Cecil Rhodes offered simple food, a cheap gun, and a few coins for 3 years of a black man's life. The black men, unsophisticated and naive, accepted those wages and made their master a multimillionaire many times over.